Tonight's show is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, Vendetti Optics, and you, our listeners. The Golden Gate Recreation Area, Presidio, the Marin Headlands, the Fort, the Batteries, the nudist beaches, it's all there. All for your viewing pleasure. What is up, all of you wayward souls, and welcome back to the Wayward Stories Podcast. Wayward Stories is the podcast where we tell the tales of our adventures and our wanderings and our wonderings. How are you guys doing this week? We're back. It's time once again to go on a little adventure. And tonight, I'm excited because we're going to take a little trip back in time to some of my adventures of the past. But before we do that, we're going to do a short little bit of housekeeping. I owe someone a thank you first and foremost. What you see before you, if you are watching on the YouTube channel, is a notebook to help assist with search and rescue. It's Search and Rescue ICS 214 notebook. This little notebook was designed, created, and sent to me by one Crystal Stone from Southwest Oklahoma Search and Rescue. For any of you that do not know what this is, any of you that are not in the know or Search and Rescue members, ICS 214 is one of those forms that we have to fill out whenever we complete a search to basically document everything that we've done as part of the Incident Command System, hence ICS. It's further a part of NIMS, National Incident Management System. There's a lot of stuff that we have to do and get certified in order to function, well, you know what, in order to play well with one another. All of the National Incident Command System, the FEMA IDs, all that, that all was basically a product of a somewhat infamous response to Hurricane Katrina, if you might recall. The federal government took a lot of heat for that. And anyway, the ICS system, the NIM system, all of that was created in response to that situation to make things flow a lot more smoothly and interagency operability to go a lot better, because you get a lot of agencies, they're all using their own different kinds of code. I actually usually tell people, because this takes less than 10 seconds, I can tell you the entire incident command system rules that you need to know in like 10 seconds, and that is you don't take orders from and you do not report to anyone other than who you are assigned to do that with, and basically no 10 codes, because 10 codes get bungled, you know, like 10-22, I'm 10-4, you know. Anyway, across different systems, those don't actually mean the same thing in different services, and sometimes bad things happen. We've talked about that on the podcast before, so we talk about using plain language, like basically just say what you mean. Oh, and also proper phonetics when you do need to spell something out. And that's all just a part of NIMS, the incident command system. But anyway, Crystal Stone, being the entrepreneurial person that she is, maybe I should say constructive more so than anything, because this is not an attempt to make money, but an attempt to be helpful. And what it is it's a notebook that has some of the basic things that we need to know at the end of every mission that's pocket size to go along with you so you can make notes as you go, because I assure you, and if you listen to Late Night Hike or Late Night Rescue on the Ozark Highland, I can assure you it's hard to remember all the things that you really need to remember as you're out there looking for someone, especially say in the middle of the night in rough terrain, and you're managing a lot of things. Everyone in and of themselves is managing a lot of things. It's a lot to keep up with. So a little handy dandy booklet like this is actually indispensable. And I cannot wait to actually have the opportunity to use this. So Crystal, thank you so much for sending this our way. And if anyone out there is search and rescue and would like to get their hands on this, just get onto Amazon.com and look for Search and Rescue ICS 214 notebook. And I'm sure if you attach Crystal Stone's name to it, Crystal with a K, you will find what you're looking for. So you guys should go get one of these. Beyond that, standard housekeeping. Please like and subscribe. Please leave a rating and review of the show. If you want to get in touch, mywaywardstory@gmail.com. And for anything else you would like to know about us, www.waywardstories.com. And with that, let's move on into tonight's show, which I have tentatively entitled California Dreamin' Volume 3, probably Central California Coast, or perhaps California Highway 1. Haven't decided yet, because California Highway 1 goes a long way, like the entire length of California from north to south. And we're only going to talk about a very particular section in the Central Coast, and even inside of that, we're only going to talk about a little portion of that. The Central, I don't know if any of you guys have looked here lately, California is freaking huge, especially when you're talking about up and down, north and south. So the section I'm going to talk about, I got to explore over 3 wonderful months, some 5 years ago, right now, this month, last month, this month, next month. That's part of why we're back with it tonight. There are a few different reasons. One is school is still being school. I'm still not getting to do a lot of the adventures I have in the past as I try to make a studious attempt at improving my life circumstances. And my adventures have kind of stalled, some of the better ones. And of course, a lot of the other things we do that we've already talked about. So I'm kind of sitting here with, okay, I've got to come up with content. We've got to keep this little mini juggernaut rolling along. And last year I put out California Dreamin' Volume 1 and California Dreamin' Volume 2, along with Nomad Spirit, Sedentary Life, all three of which have been great episodes, great downloads for those episodes. If you haven't listened, go back to roughly a year ago, right now, or from right now, and check those out, because they're all coming from the same place, which is I have that nomad spirit, but I am stuck in a very much sedentary life as I have to do certain adult things, and my adventures are pretty much limited to things within a few hour drive of me, which is great for the show, because that's part of what we're here to do, is give you guys ideas and tell you, look, you don't have to go for the big stuff all the time. There's local stuff too, but you can only do so much local stuff, and I'm running out of stories. So we're going to wrap up what I intended to do 1 year ago, which was go ahead and put out California Dreamin' Volume 3. But then we started getting those Sherpa collaborations. I started getting to take a lot of cool adventures and write those articles, and I was able to put this off and save it for a rainy day. Well, today it is raining, not literally, very much metaphorically. And I am here in Arkansas, unable to go on any amazing adventures for a little while. And so we're going to talk about my time in California some 5 years ago. And it's about right, because it's been 5 years. And so my Google Photos, as well as Facebook and other social media sites, are like 5 years ago today. And it just makes my heart very nostalgic and sad, because in my life, I don't think I've ever been anywhere that I maybe loved as much as I loved being right there on the fringes of San Francisco for those 3 months down there with such easy access to Big Sur and the California coast. Any of you listening that have not been to California, especially some of those of you that are in the American South, drop your prejudices at the door and just listen tonight. Because one of the things I've said in every episode I've ever mentioned California in is those folks are some of the most misrepresented people in modern American South. Everyone's supposed to hate Californians for whatever reason. And like I said, I've never been to Los Angeles, and maybe that's where they get their bum rap. But the people I found in the Central Coast region and in San Francisco itself and in Santa Cruz, in San Jose, were some of the coolest people, man. I loved the people out there in general, and I loved the area. Every day, it's like being on vacation. You're just at work. I'm just out there delivering packages for Big Purple. And I pull up in the yard of just a tiny little house that's probably $25 million out there in their market. But there's like citrus trees in the yard. And it's just everywhere you look, it's always golden hour out there. I don't know if that's the sea air coming in off the ocean and all the humidity, or the fact that you're on the edges of certain little mountain ranges. I don't know what it is, but it's always some form of golden hour there, and pictures take themselves. If you can't take a good picture on the Central Coast, you have some seriously deficient equipment, or you just need to give up photography. I don't care who you are, you're going to look like a professional photographer on the Central Coast of California. And it's just somewhat coincidentally that we come back to this now after my last episode, which was the one where, you know, same wayward, different wilderness, where I talked about, like, I'm kind of struggling with, where do I go from here? Because where this journey started to land at this crossroads I'm at right now started 5 years ago, right here on the California coast. That's where I found myself. That is where Justin knew what his soul was about. and everything since then has been trying to build to the point to get back to something like that. I'll tell you a little story about how many of you have heard of Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. If you're a podcast listener, chances are you've heard of Dan Carlin. If you're not, go check him out, especially if you like long-form podcasts. You only get two a year, but they're 6 freaking hours long. And for someone like me, delivery driver by trade, I'm in love with it, especially since I'm a history nerd and there's no one that can tell anything in history like Dan Carlin can. And I was actually listening to one of his companion podcasts, Hardcore History Addendum, recently, where he interviewed Rick Rubin. And Rick Rubin's just apparently, well, I know this, but he's a very, very famous record producer, and he's a different kind of guy, and he and Dan are apparently friends, and they just had like this 3-hour interview on Hardcore History Addendum, and I listened to it, and I took a lot out of that, because there's a whole lot about creativity in that episode, and many other things, but the point that I bring it up for tonight is that Dan Carlin, at one point towards the end of the episode, is talking about his father, and his father apparently grew up in Brooklyn, somewhere, I think it was Brooklyn, kind of in the tough streets of Brooklyn back in whatever decade that was, go back far enough, because when the Korean War, I believe it was the Korean War, rolled around, his father signed up to get away from the streets of Brooklyn, and they also were drafting people, and he knew that, you know, if you sign up and you enlist, you get a little bit more control over where you get sent, as opposed to getting drafted to where they tell you where you're going. And nobody wants to be a bullet catcher. So his dad signed up and they said, where do you want to go? And he said, as far away from here as possible. And so they sent him to Hawaii. And apparently, the way, as Dan tells it, this story said his mother had always told him that that had such an impact on his father to go from the dirty, grimy, impoverished streets of Brooklyn to Hawaii and do a tour out there. It changed him in a way. And she said that he spent the rest of his life trying to find Hawaii from that time period again. Went all over the world for the rest of his life trying to find somewhere that made him feel like his initial reaction when he arrived out there. And that resonated so strongly with me because that's what the Central Coast of California was to me. I grew up in an impoverished area in the sticks on the outside of an impoverished area, no less. I grew up with abject poverty. I grew up with a lot of the stuff that you associated with poor backwoods people because truly I was and are, to a degree still, one of those. And to go out there, especially under the guise that I did at the time in my life that I did, I've told the story before, I dare not revisit it tonight. It was huge, and I think it affected me in the same way that I heard Dan Carlin talk about his father going from the streets of Brooklyn and poverty and dirt and grime and filth, smog, pollution, trash on the streets to freaking Hawaii. My experience was very, very similar, so that resonated with me. So it's interesting that we come back to that because I feel like I can see myself chasing for the rest of my life those days out there in California because that was a special time. And that is just an absolutely gorgeous place. So we're going to talk about some of that tonight. And we're going to go up California Highway 1 primarily. We're going to touch several things. I'm going to try to fill you in just in nuggets, a little bit of the history, the context of what's really cool to check out there, why it's cool, why it's important. But also not just the obvious stuff. There's a ton of obvious stuff like the Golden Gate Bridge. We're going to glance by that and we're going to talk about things in and around the Golden Gate Bridge. And we're going to go further north. Because I want to give you guys ideas of some of the other stuff that resides in areas like that that's just absolutely gorgeous or it has very fascinating history or something fun to urbex or rurex. We got a lot of that tonight. So let's get started on it. Before we head up Highway 1, we're going to start with the Almaden Quicksilver Mine, which is closer to Morgan Hill, which is where we were basically headquartered at when I was working for FedEx out there, because I intended to get it into the last episode, which was volume 2 over a year ago, and we just ran out of time. So I'm going to get it in tonight because it is a really, really cool place and somewhere that is a blast to hike, and it will burn your buns off. It is an awesome place to hike with some really cool history and some incredible scenery, some incredible vistas with which to view the surrounding area. So the Almaden Quicksilver Mine and it is in Santa Clara County because it's a part of the Santa Clara County Parks, and I'll give you the quick overview. Welcome to Almaden Quicksilver County Park, spectacular in natural diversity and a landmark of California history. The park is the site of over 135 years of mining activities and former home to more than 1,800 miners and their families. The park encompasses 4,163 acres. During early spring, the park offers one of the most spectacular wildflower displays in the region. Remnants of the mining area also offer an exciting look into mining operations of the latter part of the 19th century. You have the new Almaden Quicksilver Mining Museum. You have 38 miles of hiking trails, 30 miles of equestrian trails, and over 16 miles of bicycle trails. In addition, all trails are available to pet owners to walk their dogs on a leash. There are picnic tables. Remnants of mining structures can be seen throughout the park. All mines and adits have been sealed. However, the San Cristobal mine may be viewed from beyond a locked gate. For your safety, please do not climb on any structures. And now let me give you just a little bit of the cultural history so you understand what's going on, and then I'll tell you about the awesome historic structures that you can hike to and check out, which I did with one of my co-workers who cursed me a great deal by the time we were done, because I don't know if any of you guys have ever heard about San Francisco and its hills. Well, it's not just in San Francisco, it's the whole surrounding region, and their hills are extremely serious. We're talking a lot of elevation gain. The cultural history of this area is that about 10 million years ago, tectonic plate movement changed serpentine rocks into silica carbonate and deposited cinnabar, the red ore of mercury. Used for extracting gold and silver, New Almaden's mercury was instrumental in the success of the California Gold Rush and Nevada Silver Boom. Prior to this, local indigenous peoples ground the vibrant red rock for body paint and traded it. In 1845, Andres Castillero, a Mexican cavalry officer, discovered cinnabar containing mercury and made the first mining claim under the new Mexican government. Not New Mexico, the Mexican government. Castillero required money to increase mercury production and return to New Mexico for financing. Then we have the U.S., Mexican-American War. Lots of stuff goes on. Blah, blah, blah. There's a bunch of mines, quicksilver mines, in this giant district where there was old towns that sprung up. You had all kinds of settlers from all different diverse backgrounds. And if you're really interested, going to that mining museum and also getting online to read about the Almaden Quicksilver Mines will tell you everything you want to know. But for our purposes tonight, it is a beautiful area. Guys, you will see signs that tell you, watch for mountain lions. You could be stalked and eaten, as we mentioned last year on the other episodes. This is a reality of the California Central Coast, and one that I am actually all in favor of. At this point in history, with all we've done to the environment and all of the species that we've destroyed, I'm super happy that there are still big cats out there doing their job. You guys just remember to take your like bear spray and some kind of a baton and watch your back. Ultimately, watch your back. So let's talk real quickly about some of the historic structures. I only have four outlined to tell you about, so we'll continue to move on rather quickly as we go tonight. Try to keep things moving along, not harp on anything for too long. The English camp. English camp was developed for Cornish and other English-speaking miners to live, alone or with their families. Single miners typically lived in one of the local boarding houses, while married miners lived with their families in one of the dozens of houses on the hill surrounding the town. English camp has some fairly decent extant ruins for you to explore. It's one of the easier hikes to actually get to in my recollection. And that's a great place to start off a hike up the hill, as you can go to English camp. Some of the other places, San Cristobal Mine is one of the mines that we visited. San Cristobal is the only tunnel in the park which visitors can enter for any distance. The large cube of granite to the right of this mine entrance was brought, like many others like it, to Mine Hill from the Sierra Nevada Mountains to be used in mining competitions. In these rivalries, a single miner or a team of two would be timed drilling an iron spike into the rock. You can still see their work. The miners would compete in this way on special occasions, both for bragging rights and prizes. Because of the consistent hardness of this kind of rock, it is possible to compare times and drill depths with miners at other locations throughout the state. Enter the portal into San Cristobal and then double back onto Mine Hill Road. Take a right and continue heading east on Mine Hill. Okay, you can hike to San Cristobal Mine. It's a very cool place. This information I'm reading you, I printed off a year ago, roughly, and I was there over 5 years ago. You need to get online and find out how accessible San Cristobal Mine still is at any time that you might want to go out there and explore, which is true of anything I ever talk about at any point in history that you ever listen to these episodes, because things are subject to change, as we learned just recently with COVID-19, right? So you're going to want to check that out. But San Cristobal Mine is very cool and very photogenic. It is fun to explore. The Powder House. This brick building was a storehouse for the dynamite and other explosives that were used to dig deep tunnels and shafts into the mines of the hill. Right behind the Powder House is the former location of the Victoria Shaft House. This Powder House is a reconstruction of the original, which was destroyed in 1989 by a shockwave from the Loma Prieta earthquake. The building, of unusual design, featured manure insulation between dual layers of brick. This was to keep the dynamite cool so that it wouldn't sweat nitroglycerin and become much more dangerous, and to channel blast in case of those measures failing. Then we have the April Tunnel Trestle. Beneath this large structure, ore cars would dump quality ore into a wagon, or later a dump truck to be taken to the Hacienda Reduction Works for processing. Worthless slag rocks, as you can see, were simply dumped off the far edge of the trestle. The April Trestle is a great place to get pictures for all of you photographers. It was very cool. And finally, view of San Jose. You're real close to San Jose when you are at the Almaden Quicksilver Mine. If you are facing Post 11, turn around. Before you is a spectacular view of the skyscrapers and sprawling buildings that make up San Jose in the Silicon Valley. The post was placed on this side of the trail because of potential erosion in this area. The view before you has changed dramatically since 1845. Then San Jose was little more than a small pueblo, with thriving Mission Santa Clara just up the road, surrounded by endless grass meadows and the immense live oak trees. If you had returned to this viewpoint in 1920, you would have seen the Valley of Heart's Delight, with a bustling downtown San Jose at the center of unbroken miles of fruit trees. A spectacular sight, especially when in blossom. Since then, San Jose has grown to become the 10th largest city in the United States, with a population approaching 1 million people and the capital city of the world-famous heartland of electronics revolution, Silicon Valley. These are some of the things, and not all of the things, that's less than a fourth of the things it looks like, that I lined out to tell you about that I remember going to specifically myself. As I just said, there is a literal crap ton of hiking to do there, over 37 miles. There is a ton of ancient mining infrastructure for you to explore and to photograph, and I assure you, the views, like it mentions, of San Jose, but other parts of the area are absolutely stunning. There's a ton of wildlife photography opportunities, and just remember to watch your back because mountain lions. All righty, and with that, let's start working our way up California Highway 1. Basically, we're going to go from like Watsonville to Santa Cruz, which is about where we left off last time. We left off somewhere around Monterey Bay, somewhere around Watsonville. And if you continue from that area on up Highway 1, until we get to roughly Santa Cruz, you're going to come across these places that I am about to outline before we go to break. We're not going to discuss all of the beaches there, and I will point out some of the major ones that I spent a lot of time at that I did not line out for any specific stories to tell you guys. But as you head north, up from Watsonville, up California Highway 1, along the ocean, first things first, it's gorgeous. First things first, you will not drive a more beautiful stretch of highway, I think, anywhere in the United States, at the very least. Guys, especially if you're making that trip nigh on about sunset. Sometimes you were 400 to 500 feet, as my GPS would tell me, along the edge of those bluffs, with not so much sometimes as a guardrail between you and the crashing ocean below, and nothing but the vast blue expanses of the Pacific Ocean stretching out as the sun sets and then peaked beyond the horizon, and the colors in the sky, and there was usually some kind of cloud formation, some kind of weather front coming across that ocean, especially at this time of year. It was absolutely breathtaking stuff. It's almost otherworldly stuff. It's the kind of things that reside in my memory as something almost more akin to a dream. It really was that kind of beautiful. It really did have that kind of impact on me. So it's something I highly suggest goes to the top of anyone's bucket list, is a drive on any section of California's Highway 1, but I am very particularly fond of the section from south of Big Sur up to north of San Francisco, because I basically cut my California teeth on that section of California 1, and the memories are, I don't know, like I said, they're almost dreamlike in quality. It's a very beautiful place. One of the places you will come to as you head up from Watsonville, you will come to Sunset State Beach, and it is aptly named. These are some of the very best photos that I got out there when I was in California. And again, it doesn't take a pro to get good photos out there. But you want to talk about, it's perfect for sunset photos. I got so many pictures of, well, there was one in particular that I just absolutely loved, and it exists to this day on my hard drive, of a family that I did not meet and I do not know, but they were there to take family pictures. And the photographer that was working with them, well, they were doing their thing and I was back behind them, and there's a little bit of a creek. Basically, it's a river, but it's a creek, and it's cutting through the beach, constantly remaking its course as it cuts through the beach sand and making its way to the ocean. And I was there to take pictures of that confluence because it just creates some really wonderful textures and light plays for photography. It's really beautiful stuff. But this guy's got this family out there, and I don't remember, there was a, you know, a dad, a mom, and two or three kids. But I know there was one little girl who I could tell, I just loved that little girl because she did things her way. She went her own way. And as they continually tried to get that family picture, that little girl just kept jumping off into the waves and making these big splashes. And I happened to catch mid-splash one of those moments where the photographer was trying to take the photo. The family was all posed for the photo, but the little girl had just gone rogue and it jumped off to the side and was fully knees bent, splashing down into the ocean with the water spraying in all directions, and the mom's arm reaching out to try to grab her to bring her back into the photo, all in silhouette against a golden orange sky, setting sun. One of my favorite photos I've ever taken. It's one of those, a picture's worth a thousand words, because you can see the entire story of that day and that one photo, a family trying to get their family photos in a beautiful location, and a little girl that was way more interested in playing in the water, which I think any of us that have kids can totally relate to. One of my favorite pictures ever, and it's not the only picture I ever got there. I have probably an entire album's worth that came from Sunset State Beach. It was one of my favorite beaches to photograph. Got some absolutely stunning pictures there. From there, you head on up, you will come to Seacliff State Beach. Seacliff's a really interesting beach, and I enjoyed the heck out of it because it had, and this is unfortunate, past tense, it had this huge long pier, a historic pier, that went all the way out to the SS Palo Alto, which was a ship that had been sunk at the end of the pier for whatever purposes, probably, you know, like weather break purposes. I don't remember and don't really care. It was cool as heck. I think it was like a concrete ship, some kind of a merchant ship, or they filled it with concrete to sink it there to work as like a surf break. Unsure, doesn't matter. It was really cool to walk out on that pier and take pictures of that old wreck. However, I just learned this week, as I went and did a little research just to refresh myself, that pier is now closed and basically gone because of some extremely severe storms that battered the coastline there last year. So for over a year now, that pier has been, a good portion of it washed away, other portions sagging in extreme disrepair. And the area there, the city there, is working on mitigation plans to try to bring back a pier to that area, how much might could be saved of the old pier for historical purposes, how to tell the story, how to interpret the story. They're working on it, but unfortunately, at this very moment, that pier is not accessible because it doesn't actually exist, the majority of it anyway, at this time. But Seacliff was an awesome beach, and I highly suggest looking into it. Anytime into the future, if you plan to go out there, get online and check, see what parts of the beach are open, see if they've got the pier repair yet. But that was another great beach for getting pictures. I got some really cool pictures, actually, of that pier the pier in silhouette. And I had another one looking kind of down what you might call the portal. Any of you guys that like to take pictures of bridges know when you look down basically the drive part of a bridge, that's called the portal. Essentially, I was looking down what I would say is kind of the portal of this pier. And the way that the sun was setting, the light was playing across, the shadows were cutting across at a 45 degree angle, the ocean waves are breaking in again. It does not take a genius to take really good photos out there. So I had some really good pictures of that pier, and it just makes my heart really sad that the ocean reclaimed it last year. But I do have the greatest confidence that the city there will take care of business and get something back in its place. It had a lot of historic significance, and I believe it'll be back. From there, we're going to go to Twin Lakes, which is getting a lot closer into Santa Cruz area, San Jose, Santa Cruz. You're getting up into some of the urban area, but Twin Lakes has the Walton Lighthouse, Twin Lakes Beach, State Beach, Cafe Palomar, and another cafe known as Crow's Nest. Listen, the Walton Lighthouse is one of the most picturesque lighthouses you could come across at a really fun beach that's right there in kind of the heart of a bit of an urban area. So you meet a lot of really cool people. I met so many cool people there. I went back to Walton Lighthouse many times because it was an easy drive from Morgan Hill for me after work, you know, an hour maybe. And I could have, as I've mentioned in previous episodes, some 3 years ago, go get yourself the best $25 freaking burrito you'll ever get in your life. Bar none. Incredible food at Cafe Palomar. And it's a really neat beach. They have this awesome kind of jetty with the Walton Lighthouse. And when you get the sun just right, I actually have a picture of a sailboat working its way back into harbor right next to that lighthouse, as there's these kind of what we call mare's tails here in the South. I don't know what they're called elsewhere, but those wispy clouds that kind of have a little bit of a flourish to them as they are streaked and swept. A lot of people call them windswept clouds. We call them mare's tails. Got these pink mare's tails fading to blue towards the left side of the picture as the sun is setting on the right side of the picture. It's also where I got pictures of my conch dude who was out there blowing his conch with his dog who couldn't quite understand what was going on because they were all stoned out of their gourds. But he was so kind to allow me to photograph him playing his conch shell. And he was rocking, y'all. And he was rocking in a lot of ways. But regardless, I've got the sun setting right behind the lighthouse, right behind my conch shell playing dude, and his dog who's standing off to the side and looking at him quite quizzically. And that's another one of my favorite pictures. The candid photos of people at the beach definitely constitute some of my favorite photos I got out there, and silhouettes are always killer. And you get there at a good sunset. I have a really cool picture from out there of a man running out into the ocean with his surfboard in full silhouette. The ocean almost has a silvery look to it. The sun is setting, and it reeks of the vibe of like The Endless Summer. Any of you guys remember that movie? It's just got that vibe. It has that vibe. And you just can't take bad pictures on the central coast of California. It's just impossible. We're definitely past our half hour, so let's go ahead and go to break. And when we come back, we'll finish up going into Santa Cruz, and then we will head on down to, I say head on down, we'll continue to head up. Here in the South, it's up or down. Here in my part of America, you look at a map, north is up, south is down. So we're going to go further up the highway, and we're going to touch off in San Francisco, and we'll just keep on going. So you guys stick around till after the break. There's a lot more to talk about, and there's a lot of fascinating little tidbits of history and places you can explore, especially if you're into urbex kind of situations. So you guys hang around. We'll be right back. What is up, all of you wayward souls? I want to tell you guys about our newest sponsor, Bendetti Optics, a brand based right here in the good old US of A, Portland, Oregon, to be exact. And I bought my first pair of Bendetti sunglasses about a year and a half ago and fell in love with them so much so that I got online and ordered a couple of more pair. And when I did, there was a small shipping snafu, an order fulfillment snafu, and I got on the phone, gave them a call, and guess what? I get a call back from who? One of the big men themselves right there in Portland, from the top of the chain, have a great conversation, and we end up starting this great relationship we have. They more than made right the little snafu that occurred, and I am now a huge proponent of them because I can tell you from personal experience they are good people, and they are trying to compete with the big boys out there coming in at a price point of about $40, but using the exact same frame material, TR90, and the same polarization process as the big guys. As it turns out, something I think we are already probably knew in our hearts, when you buy big name sunglasses, you're buying a big name, not necessarily any more quality than you can get somewhere else, like at Bendetti Optics. They have 29 different styles. They have multiple polarization options for whatever climate you happen to live in. And they back it up with like this lifetime guarantee that if your dog eats your sunglasses, it doesn't matter how you break them, send it back in with a check to cover shipping and handling and you're golden. You got a new pair on the way. These guys are truly trying to do it right, and they have this philosophy that a really good pair of sunglasses should not cost you so much that you are afraid to wear them. And I think all of us outdoorsmen can relate to that. So if you guys, like me, are very practical and like to get more bang for your buck and wear some great looking sunglasses, check out BendettiOptics.com. That's BendettiOptics, optics.com, or you can go over to Instagram/BendettiOptics. And that I highly suggest, whether you buy a pair or not, just to check out the cutest pupper you will ever see modeling sunglasses. Once again, that's BendettiOptics.com. And make sure and let them know Wayward Stories sent you. And welcome back. Thank you guys for sticking around through our sponsor breaks. And I encourage you all to support our sponsors, because that helps keep the show going. And when you do, make sure and mention that Wayward Stories sent you over there so they know that we're getting them some bang for their bucks, even though we're not getting any bucks yet. But someday in the future, we'll get bucks for those spots that I'm talking about right now. Might be 2 decades from now. Someday it'll happen. Anyway, let's move on. So we cut off there from Twin Lakes. And as we continue on up, we'll hit the Santa Cruz Boardwalk, which is worth a mention because any boardwalk anywhere is awesome. The Santa Cruz Boardwalk is no different, and it's also a great place to people watch. The boardwalk is a lot of fun. They've got kind of a carnival situation. There's plenty of food stands, a lot of fun stuff on the boardwalk, so definitely check out the Santa Cruz Boardwalk. And then finally, moving into Santa Cruz before we head north, I've kind of got this divided into south of Santa Cruz / San Francisco and north of. I'm going to talk about Natural Bridge. Natural Bridge is a really cool sea arch formation, and it's probably Natural Bridge State Beach would be my guess. I think it is. Natural Bridge right there in Santa Cruz, and you can't miss it if you Google it. Somewhere you need to definitely stop and go check out. It's a very, very picturesque sea art situation. You can walk over very close to it, and depending on where the tide is, you can get out there very, very close to it. I went several times, had a lot of adventures over there, and so I went to this and photographed it at several different times of day. Well, really more different times of evening hours as the sunset. Got a lot of cool pictures and a lot of cool pictures of seabirds. Those seabirds will perch all over that arch. And it's really, really fun to go and watch them interact as the waves crash in and the birds will fly away and then they'll come back. Very neat place. A lot of fun people watching, a lot of fun photographic opportunities, but mind your business because the ocean will kill you. Okay, this is where I had probably my closest call of my entire life. I got overtaken by what is known as a sneaker wave. This is where I learned what a sneaker wave was. Didn't know they existed. Talked about it 3 years ago, but we're kind of bringing some of these stories back with a little bit fresher perspective. And for all of you that have never heard them, but this is where I got the closest to dying ever. This is probably even in the episode entitled Close Calls, because this is as close as it's ever gotten for me. But to recap in a nutshell, there was an angry ocean, as was pretty commonly the case, I guess, around this time of year, because it was the case when I was there throughout my different 3 months of my stretches there. And the ocean was brutally battering against this small little bluff, maybe 6-8 feet up off the water. And of course, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to get as close as I can to take as many pictures as I can. And the waves are just breaking into the bluff, not over the bluff. Look safe enough to me, right? So I head out there and I set up for my shot. And all of a sudden, I see out of the corner of my eye the water breaking much, much higher than the bluff that I was standing on. And I fortunately, thank goodness, this is probably what saved my bacon, is I saw it coming with enough time in my cat-like reflexes, right, to brace myself, take on a, as we used to call, a kind of a ready stance or a football stance, you know? You bend your knees a little bit, you lean into the impact. And I had just enough time to sort of do that. I didn't get really set, but I was able to lean into it. And leaning into it kept it from knocking me flat on my back. And that's probably what saved me. Because after that wave broke over me, all of that seawater that went over my head was now rushing back off the cliff into the water 6 to 8 feet below, which is a churning ocean against the rocks. And I could feel like my feet losing traction. I was sliding forward ever so slightly. I don't really know exactly how to describe that. Have you ever seen a glass of water that is condensed enough that the glass starts to slide across a table or maybe a marble countertop or a wooden table or something, and it actually starts to move on its own? It's kind of creepy. If you've never witnessed that, it's a thing that happens. And all it is like enough condensation, water got underneath it, and it just starts to kind of slide across on this little thin membrane of water molecules or whatever. That's what it felt like. I was sliding towards the ocean ever so slightly, that was only a couple of feet away, with all that pressure against the back of my legs, up to about my knees is what I felt. As it was draining off, it did get lower, but it started high, and I was like, I'm going off. And I had time to actually think through my plan of action, which included dumping my backpack, getting my shoes off, and getting as much of the crap off of me as I could by the time I was into the water so that I could swim away from the churning ocean beating against the jagged rocks and hopefully get a shot to swim back around and come up into the sandy part of the beach, which even that probably wouldn't have been guaranteed. There's rip currents. There's a lot of things. I don't know how to read the ocean like I do a mountain river because I've never been out there that much. But I knew the only hope was to get all the freaking heavy crap off of me, including my shoes, as fast as I could and swim. Fortunately, it didn't come to that. The water receded, I was still left standing, and I beat feet out of there and had a long, cold drive in my soaking wet boxer shorts all the way back to Morgan Hill, hoping I didn't get pulled over by the cops, because that would have looked pretty weird. Anyway, Natural Bridge is a super cool beach to check out as you work your way up Highway 1. There's some great photos to be had there. Beaches not discussed in that section from Watsonville on up to the Santa Cruz area, just for the sake of time, and nothing extremely, well, actually a lot of, some stuff did happen at these beaches, but there's not time in tonight's episode. Moss Landing, Manresa, La Selva, Rio Del Mar, and Seabright were all really, really cool beaches with lots of cool stuff to check out, lots of great photo opportunities. I will say Moss Landing, which is right really in Watsonville, is the place where I learned that even grown burly-ass men like myself can be lured into bad situations where you might find yourself, you know, with a predator. And I'm just saying, you can go back and listen to, I don't even remember, I talked about it before. If you're interested enough, send me an email. We'll talk about it. But listen, everyone can be a target for someone, and even people like me, with all the different trainings I have and different things I've done in my life, let a dude who was talking to me like an old country boy, like, hey, look at what I did to the engine of my truck. Well, I don't really care about your engine, but you know, I'm a nice guy. I can do that. He wanted to show me his camper that he had tricked out, that he lives in, you know? I thought it was another friendly nomad spirit. And before I knew it, I was in a camper trailer, alone on a beach, with a guy who didn't want me to go out the other side. It's a story for a different time. Everyone can be a target. Don't be unaware of that. Any of you, men, women, doesn't matter. All of us can find ourselves in a screwed up situation like that. That happened at Moss Landing. Let's move on from Santa Cruz to the north. Another awesome beach to check out is Shark Fin Cove, thus named because there's a giant, and I mean enormous, rock formation right in the middle of this fairly tight little cove in the coast that looks a whole lot like an enormous shark's fin. Like, we're talking way bigger than a megalodon. This is a huge rock formation. Looks like a shark's fin. Very, very cool place. And one of my favorite things about Shark Fin Cove, number one, it is extremely picturesque because the mouth of it's fairly narrow. comparative to the bay. It opens up a little bit, and then you get like this little waterfall thing coming out of like, it's a cave. It looks like a culvert, but it's so deep below the land above, you know, tens of dozens of feet, you know, I don't know, 60, 80 feet, maybe more. I don't know if it's natural or if someone tunneled that in there as a drainage. I think it's not natural. It's been a while since I've been there, or that it's man-made, but it's cool. There's basically a small little river creek thing pouring out into the beach, running down into the ocean, into this fairly tight little cove that has a sea cave over here to your left. And if the water's low enough, you can walk through it. If the water's higher, you cannot walk through it, but you can still photograph it. And you got the big rock formation that they call Shark's Fin. But one of the coolest things about it to me is you have to climb across old railroad tracks that have been abandoned for a long, long time and go down through them to get down to the ocean. And for me, it's, you know, the history nerd that I am and a person that loves old railroad history, I had to look into that. And it's something that you ought to check into. And I still to this day say somebody's missing a huge opportunity at revamping that line for tourism dollars, because you want to talk about people who would pay a premium, and you're looking at one of them, to take a passenger train ride down the coast of California, even closer to the ocean in most places than Highway 1 itself gets. Holy crap. But it's super cool, super cool, super fun to explore. So, Shark Fin Cove, one of my favorite go-tos for photography. I went back several times, and there's a lot of really cool sea creature life that hangs out in the little tidal pools that get on the top of some of those rocks. You can get some really, really cool pictures of these strange little, I don't know, it's sea life. I am not a biologist. I'm an anthropologist, so I couldn't tell you. And a cultural one at that. I'm not even a biological anthropologist, so I don't even know. But it's really interesting looking sea life. I got some pretty cool pictures of. So there's a lot you can do at Shark Fin Cove. And again, all of this is set against the backdrop of you're driving freaking California 1 up the coast of California. The Golden Coast, y'all. Like, actually, it's the Central Coast. The Golden Coast is like the southern portion, isn't it? I don't know. Not from California. Don't send me an email, because it doesn't matter that much. But it's absolutely beautiful. So all of this is against that backdrop, that the whole drive you're taking is a beautiful endeavor with mountains to one side, a crashing ocean to the other, and these jagged coastlines. This isn't like the little sandy beaches that you come across in Florida and the Gulf of Mexico and Pensacola and all these places go. This is raw, natural beauty, where the ocean meets the land and they violently, violently meet. It's really, really cool. So let's move on up from Shark Fin Cove and let's talk about Big Basin Redwood State Park. The redwoods are something everyone should see in their life, and you should camp within them anytime you get the chance. I got to do this when I was in California on a couple of occasions. I absolutely loved it. You got to do it though in designated camping areas and parks where you can camp. I tried to look because I didn't camp in Big Basin. I did go to Big Basin, but I didn't camp there. I went down, I was in Julia Pfeiffer Burns State Park area and stuff down in Big Sur area. And I couldn't find absolute yes or no. I'm thinking it's no to camping in Big Basin Redwood State Park. So you'd have to look into that. But everyone should go and see them, guys. And there's a real story, and I'm going to give you some of this cultural context because it's important in today's age as much, every bit as much as it was then. And it will also give you a greater appreciation of how amazing that place is, how amazing the redwoods are, and how important it is that A, you go see them for yourself, but B, understand the history behind them and why it's so important to protect things like this. Big Basin's coastal redwoods, Sequoia sempervirens, are native to the United States. They grow only along the coast from southern Oregon to central California. The genus name Sequoia may honor Sequoia, the 19th century inventor of the Cherokee alphabet, and sempervirens means ever living. These trees are part of a once huge ancient forest, of which today only 5% still remains. The Santa Cruz Redwood Forest was first noted in accounts of a Spanish coastal expedition led by Gaspar del Portoya in 1769. After the gold rush, less than a century later, logging threatened to deplete the forest. By 1884, the area's 28 sawmills were processing more than 34 million board feet of lumber, shingles, railroad ties, and posts annually. As logging continued, the battle to protect the ancient trees in the heart of Big Basin began. Photographer Andrew P. Hill, journalist Josephine McCracken, and writer-publisher Carrie Stevens Walter, and a growing coalition of journalists, politicians, artists, and scholars formed the Sempervirens Club in May of 1900. As Walter wrote, "Once gone, no human power or ingenuity can replace them. Even the most callous-minded materialist does not love to think of this swirling globe as a treeless place." The establishment of Big Basin Redwood State Park in 1902 marked the beginning of the preservation and conservation movement in California and provided the vision for the hundreds of California state parks we enjoy today. See, I think this is interesting, and one reason I want to talk about it, because what did I talk about in the last episode? Your John Muirs, your Thoreaus, your Emersons, Pinchots, a lot of those guys. This right here is the creation, the beginning of, in California, the beginning of that conservation and preservation movement that I talked about in the last episode. So this was fascinating to me. In 1900, and also let me point out, the redwoods were what served as almost the poster child. This became the banner that was hoisted nationwide to bolster support for the protection of some of our irreplaceable things like redwoods. This is it. This is the genesis right here. And this was the thing that was used to, again, be a banner for everyone to unite under to save. A lot of what we have today came from this right here, the California redwoods. In 1900, San Jose photographer Andrew P. Hill photographed the coast redwood trees in Welch's Grove, now part of Henry Cowell Redwood State Park. The owner of the forest accused Hill of trespassing and demanded his negatives. Hill refused, vowing to himself to save the trees for future generations and make public park of this place. After a landmark meeting at Stanford University in May of 1900, Santa Cruz businessmen led Hill journalists and politicians on an excursion to Big Basin, an ancient forest threatened by logging. After 3 days of exploring the forest's wonders, the group elected officers and formed the Sempervirens Club. The club and its growing team of supporters pushed state legislature to approve a bill to purchase the land. The bill passed unanimously, and thus was established California Redwood Park, known since 1927 as Big Basin Redwood State Park. The bill also established the California Redwood Park Commission. In 1906, after much debate, the commission acquired 3,901 acres from the Big Basin Lumber Company through purchase and donation. Another 3,785 acres were converted from federal land to the state park in 1916. So there you go. That is the creation, the beginning of preservation movement, conservation movement in California, and highlights the conservation and preservation movements that occurred throughout the United States during this period of time, the late 1800s into the early 1900s, and continued on into the mid-1900s. And it is an ongoing battle today and has become highly politicized, and I'm not going to go there, but you need to know that once this crap's gone, it's gone and we all die. Just understand that. Plain terms, once it's gone, it's gone, and we all die, and your politics will be damned at that point. So let's use our critical thinking skills, boys and girls. Let's grow up, be mature, and put on our critical thinking hats and consider the actual implications of destroying all the things on this planet rather than what talking heads on the news tell us in order to inflame our tensions and make us hate other people so that we can continue to vote monsters into power. There you go. I said what I said. Moving on, from Big Basin's Redwood State Park, which, again, you should absolutely visit, the redwoods, there's nothing like them, guys. Until you see a tiny dot that is a human standing next to this enormous tree, you can't even comprehend the scope, and it will change how you look at the world. It will make you think of, I don't know, something like Jurassic or Triassic. It makes you feel like you're looking at a rainforest from a period of where dinosaurs roamed the earth, guys, because they are enormous. It looks like a different landscape from a different planet. I cannot say enough how important I think it is for every human to once stand amongst the redwoods themselves and see it, because it will change you. It will change you. How it will change you, that's different for everyone, but I promise you it will change something inside of you. It'll make you look at the world just a little bit differently. But let's move on up the coast. All right, we're going to go ahead and get into the Golden Gate area so we can keep tonight's show rolling. I'm not going to talk a lot about the Golden Gate Bridge. It's super cool. Alcatraz is right there in the bay. Also pretty cool. But let's not focus on those tonight, because you can go read and learn all about those all you want. Things that I think are even cooler in the general area around the Golden Gate Bridge. One, the Presidio. Just look it up. Look it up for yourself. Read all about it. It has an enormous amount of history all the way back into Spanish colonization of the area. And even before that, when it was the Olone people, some of the earliest Native Americans we know to be established in the area, which is, I think, about 500 CE, best I can understand it. And before that, I'm sure there were even older back into archaic times. But the Presidio is really cool. But beyond that, if you're into like urbex, and again, you know, photography is photography anywhere on the coast, but the Golden Gate Bridge is incredibly photogenic, as you might expect. But beyond that, there's more going on there. One of them is the many, many forts and bits of forts and pillboxes and coastal defenses that were all around San Francisco during World War II. Japanese attack on the U.S. mainland was a very real concern. Whether it was ever actually a super threat or not is debatable, probably not, but there were things that happened out there on the coast. I mean, there were shots fired around San Diego from a Japanese torpedo at one point. There, a little bit of stuff happened out there. But California, well, the bay there in San Francisco, it was well defended because there's a lot of important military stuff going on in there. And all throughout, well, along Highway 1, but all through the Golden Gate Recreation Area, there are old pillboxes just embedded into the sides of hills, gun turrets, portions of forts that remain in place. Guys, if you like urbex, there are things you can go see there. Super fun to look at, super fun to photograph, and super fun to explore and just consider the history of the area. Because for me, coming in as an outsider, I was a little bit surprised to see gun emplacements, which I knew from just my background in history, what a gun emplacement, what a pillbox looked like. I was like, why is there a pillbox on the side of the hill right by my head on Highway 1 as I'm moving on the, you know, coming up on the Golden Gate Bridge and the Golden Gate Recreation Area? I was like, why is that there? Super fascinating stuff. Both sides of the bay, there are remnants of forts, remnants of gun emplacements, remnants of pillboxes, and pillboxes themselves still in place that you can explore, see, and photograph. That to me is one of the coolest things there. And also, there is a fort. I believe it's Civil War era fort that is still in place right below the Golden Gate Bridge. I think that's Civil War era. I'm almost positive, actually, but I'm not stopping this episode to go and check. That fort itself is very cool. And I warn you, if you go and get very adventurous, heading down below the bridge to get photographs, and you make it to the actual bay itself, and you explore along, you'll probably remember this if any of you were around long enough to be here 3 years ago when I made the first episode about this area. There are naked people below the southern end of the Golden Gate Bridge. There is a nudist beach down there. There are no signs that warn you, at least that I saw. Maybe there are. But there are lots of, let's say, elderly nude people down there. I'm sure elderly are not the only ones down there nude, but the day I was there and stumbled into that unexpectedly, listen, I'm just going to say the years had not been good to some of them. That's probably about as kindly as I can put it. I'm sure there may have been younger people there, but I did not make it that far into the nudist beach. You guys do you. You go get bohemian. But just for all the rest of you, just know, be warned. Be warned. It's there. Anyway, let's move on up the coast from there. Also, the Marin Headlands. That is a part of the whole situation there with the Golden Gate Preserve, the Golden Gate Recreation Area, Presidio, the Marin Headlands, the forts, the batteries, the nudist beaches. It's all there. All for your viewing pleasure, I suppose, depending on who you are and what you're into. So, oh, you know what? One more thing. I do need to talk about this, too. Because if you're in that area, you may hear and you may have heard elsewhere about the glass beaches out there on the coast of California. When I was working in that terminal in Watsonville, the actual terminal manager told me about the glass beach that he said was in San Francisco. And I was like, what is the glass beach? And he told me this story about these glass beaches. And what it is it's very actually fascinating. This is history, y'all. People used to just dump their trash straight off into the ocean. And in San Francisco particularly, a lot of that trash came from the 1906 earthquake. Maybe you've heard of it. I don't care what school you went to. That's something that got touched on in history class at some point when you were in elementary school. A lot of that stuff got pushed into the ocean for lack of anywhere else to put it. And, you know, the ocean seemed deep enough. Seemed like a natural repository, I suppose. And anyway, over the years, as things broke down and those glass bottles and old car taillights that were actually made of glass, all these things, medicine bottles, beer bottles, whiskey bottles, you know, porcelainware, all these things that are glass, through continuous wave action for decades and decades and decades, have been beaten to pieces against the beaches of the California coast and have turned these chunks and shards of glass into these little rounded polished glass stones and fragments. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's completely illegal to take any of that stuff. At that time, he didn't say that to me. He said, we go do it all the time, especially after a big storm. Well, when in Rome, right? When in San Francisco, do as the San Franciscans do. I mean, just the day before, I was naked on a nude beach. I did not say that. That's not what actually happened. Let me take that back. No, really, I did not join them. I assure you, that was just for funsies. But when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And I went and I got me some glass from the glass beach. I didn't get much. I had to search really hard. Got a small handful, brought some back for my daughter, and some exist in a little box I have over there with many of the things I found on that adventure during those days. It's like my little memory box. Got some beach sand, got some sand dollars, got, you know, lots of different things in there. I can open it and fondly remember the days I was there. But I believe that glass, probably illegal to take in most places, there is a place, and actually the actual glass beaches, it turns out, are not in San Francisco, though there's obviously some, but they're in Mendocino County right up the road in Fort Bragg, and there's a dude there that's been making like tens of thousands of pieces of jewelry forever. If you go read about this, he's like staunchly against the authorities. He's like, it is not illegal to take it. They know it. That's why I'm not in jail, and they can't stop you, and they can't find you, and they know it. He sounds sort of kind of like one of my kind of guys, but at the same time, I don't know. It is sea glass that is not like some kind of natural recurring thing. This is the glass of trash dumps that were dumped into the ocean. So I don't feel nearly as morally whatever about that, but it is also considered probably archaeological site, historical situation. And in some places, I'm absolutely positive it's probably definitely off limits to take that glass. And you just need to be aware of that. But for photography purposes, I never made it to Mendocino to actually get the photos of the full-on glass beach situation, though I've seen pictures and I wish I had. And it's worth mentioning here for you guys to consider to check out for yourself someday. Just take the glass at your own risk if you decide to. It may be illegal and you should check all federal, state, and local laws concerning such a thing. That is the proviso, the addendum, the asterisk that the we are not responsible for your court cost or your fines. Let's just put it that way. Wayward Stories shall not be held responsible for any laws that you break. Okay, so we're going to move on up the beach a little bit and we've definitely hit our time for tonight. So let's do... Well, Point Reyes National Seashore. That was really the northernmost point that I ever landed at when we were adventuring. I went on several adventures with several of my friends. Point Reyes is, well, A, really beautiful. It's a nature preserve. It's very cool. There is a historic radio station, Point Reyes Radio Station, there, which served wartime purposes during World War II. It's once a year now, I think, goes online. It's an old Marconi station. Okay, Guillermo Marconi invented essentially, well, he didn't invent Morse code, but he created the technology that allowed for Morse code to go out over the wires. And it was a Marconi station far back in the day. It's been there for well over 100 years. And it's also home to the famous Cypress Tree Tunnel, not to be confused with the Redwood Tunnel, you know, tree tunnels that you can drive a car through, but just cypress trees that were planted nearly 94 years ago at this point, makes for some awesome photography. I've told that story before, but you've got that historic site and you can actually explore it if you're there during their operational hours. It's all preserved, very cool to check out. but it's absolutely beautiful. There's this huge, like, crescent moon-shaped bay almost. It almost looks like a freaking meteor impact crater, like you see down in Central America or something. It is not, apparently, but it kind of looks like it. It's so just symmetrically curved and very crescent moon-shaped, beautiful to photograph. It is known as Drake's Bay because it is supposedly where Sir Francis Drake landed when he was completing his circumnavigation of the globe. And there is a Spanish galleon that sank in that bay at some point. That is confirmed. There's a lot going on there, guys. It's really cool to check out. A lot of fun stuff to explore. I really enjoyed Point Reyes Station. Point Reyes National Seashore is over here. Point Reyes Station is just a few miles west, and it's just a little town, a junction on a highway, and it is a neat coastal town. It reminded me when I was there of something what I might think of like a New England fishing town as like. It's just got that vibe. It's got really neat little restaurants. It's got some great places to eat. It's got fun little shops. They have their own gold coin. It's not really gold, but they got their own coin that's worth basically $3 that is recognized tender in Point Reyes Station. I bought my daughter one, and it resides on her dresser to this day, back there in her bedroom. And she just thinks that's the coolest thing ever. I shipped that back from her via, you guessed it, Big Purple, when I was out there working for Big Purple. And it got there overnight, literally by 10 a.m. the next day for like $7 because I got an employee discount. It was pretty fantastic. I was shocked it got there that quickly. But anyway, they have their own coinage, their own legal tender, this little $3 coin. It's very, very cool. You buy them, you know, essentially for keepsakes, or you can go spend them and buy yourself a soda pop. But Point Reyes Station itself is not actually on the ocean. It's just a really cool little town right there, kind of in the heart of the Point Reyes National Seashore area. And also just up from it is Tamales Bay, which is also very cool. Super, super long, like inlet from the ocean. And it's shaped like, I don't know, something long and rectangular in a way. It just doesn't look right. Bays are usually kind of wide open mouth bays, right? This thing actually is very, very narrow and extremely long. It feels like you drive beside it forever when you actually venture to drive along beside it. It's very, very cool. Very beautiful. Tons of like birding for you guys that are into birding. I'm not so much into birding though. I took several cool pictures of birds because they kind of just present themselves to you out there. But there's a ton of wildlife photography, especially birds, out there along Tamales Bay. And also they've got this shipwreck that basically just hangs out behind this little property. You can go photograph it unless something's changed since, you know, what I read online, plus when I was there 5 years ago. But you can go photograph it, get some really cool pictures of this old fishing boat that's basically beached up in Tamales Bay. You can get real close to it depending on the tide. So that's something else to consider. All in all, going up to Point Reyes, if you're staying anywhere in the San Francisco area, should just be considered a really fun, long day trip. Take an entire day for it. Enjoy the drive. Enjoy the gorgeous countryside. Enjoy Redwoods. Enjoy Drake Bay. Like Drake's Bay? Yeah, Drake's Bay. Enjoy that. Go and see everything there is to see because it is its own thing. It's its own subculture of people. It's its own general geography of culture of the United States. And it's just absolutely gorgeous. As I've said before, if you're in California, it's going to cost you out the nose because their cost of living is exorbitant. But it's worth it to go and see it. It's worth it to spend a week out there. If you could ever do that, go and do it. Go and do it. It is truly the location of some of my fondest memories that I've ever basically made in my entire life. That was a coming of something, not age so much, but it was a transformative moment for me as a human. And it informed so much of where I've come from since then and where I'm still intending to go from where I'm at. But it changed me. The Central Coast of California changed me. Big Sur, all the way up to Point Reyes. That is a place that informs most of where I've gone and who I've started to craft myself into being, because there's nothing like that. There's just nothing like that. so many of those places are like I talked about so many episodes ago, a couple of years ago, in the episode Sacred Places. There are a lot of sacred places along the Central California coast, and they're just there. They're just waiting for you to come and find them. But you have to go. You have to choose to live your life and get off your butt and go out there and find them. So take the old wayward son's advice. Start a savings account. Knock off a couple of liquor stores if you have to. Don't do that. At some point, make your way to the Central Coast. Spend some time there. Explore some of these places. I mean, it impacted me enough that someday when I die, I absolutely plan and intend for my ashes to be spread on some of those beaches along that bay. Several of them, actually. Different story for a different episode. We have run on past our hour for tonight, and this is as good a place as any to wrap up tonight's episode. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. I hope you've gotten some ideas of places to go explore if you ever make it out to the Central Coast of Cali. I hope that you think about this as a template. All the things we ever talk about is like, man, he's pointing out like these pillbox bunkers, and he's pointing out like this glass beach situation, and he's pointing out like Fort Bragg and their glass beaches, and all these little Almaden Quicksilver Mine. Guys, those places exist everywhere in the United States. Somewhere like those places exist somewhere within a few hours of you, anywhere you are in the United States, except maybe Kansas. I'm sorry, Kansas. I can't help it. You're too easy to pick on, but I love you, Kansans. Thank you for the bread. Anyway, you guys, consider these as a template, just ideas. This is the kind of stuff Justin likes to explore. Yeah, I did go check out Golden Gate. Yeah, I did go explore Yosemite 4 times, no less. I did all those things, but I found almost even more gratifyingly, might be a way to say it, or satisfyingly even, all of these little stories along the way, all of these little histories that are being told, all of the reasons this part of the country is what it is how it is. That stuff exists everywhere in the United States. You don't have any excuses to keep yourself from getting out and exploring the world. Anyway, I hope you guys make the choice to get out and live your lives, no matter where you are. You guys rate, review, subscribe, all the things we always talk about, means the world to us. And get in touch. If you got anything you want to talk about, if you got any stories you want to tell me that you'd like to have told on the show, itineraries, your coming of whatever story, how you found yourself, feel free to share it with me if you would like to have it shared with our audience, and we will work it out. We'll make it happen. Until the next time that we meet, I hope you guys get out there and find something to get into, and remember to be good to each other.